The KFJC Public Affairs Department presents Radio Free America. Tonight, part two of the broadcast, looking back from 1984, a hidden history of the Cold War. Well, good evening, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. This is Nip Tuck, and again, want to welcome you aboard on behalf of radio station KFJC and the KFJC Public Affairs Department, and also, of course, on behalf of myself and Dave Emery. Dave is here, right here in the studio next to me.
Hopefully.
And we want to welcome you on board for the second broadcast, although it's actually the second half of the first broadcast, which gets a little tricky. But the second broadcast of the Radio Free America Archives program. Tonight, part two of a broadcast we began a little over a month ago, entitled Looking Back from 1984, A Hidden History of the Cold War. And before we start into the information, we want to tell you folks a few physical details about what's going to be going on here tonight, because it is it's a lot of stuff, and we realize that quite a few of the people out there are going to want to be taping. And believe me, you have my full sympathy if 4 hours straight of the kind of information that we're going to be handing out, which is some pretty heavy-duty stuff, makes it difficult for you to sit still for the whole thing to listen.
In fact, really, this is sort of in keeping with a KFJC tradition in which I guess you might call the dominant aesthetic up here self-consciously innovative. And this is really, as far as we know, a new kind of broadcasting. These shows are meant to be taped. If you can sit and listen to 4 hours of what we're about to present you, you're a better man than I am, or better person, or whatever, because I don't think I could sit and listen to 4 hours of this and get very much out of it. So the idea is to be taping so that we can hand you, and I mean hand you, 4 hours worth of hard documentation. It would probably take you at least 2 years of research for every hour's worth of taping. And although this is a difficult format, you're getting a real bargain. So, but they're really meant to be taped. I don't know about you, Nipper, I can't imagine sitting and just listening to this.
So. Well, indeed. I'm sure that a lot of you out there will be turning it on and tuning it out to step out and have a cold one every now and then and things of that sort. We're fully cognizant of that, and no brownie points will be subtracted for that. Anyway, once again, after about another 5 minutes or so of explanatory stuff, or maybe less perhaps, we will be entering into the actual information part of the broadcast. We think we're going to go pretty well right up through 11 o'clock tonight, unfortunately. In terms of phones, we probably will not be having phones. However, those of you who are still up and around at 10 or 10:30 will probably want to be aware we might indeed have time to take some phone calls, and if so, we certainly will. But again, don't count on it, and if you have a pressing question, we do have other programs here at KFJC in which we encourage phone calls on precisely this type of material, so be aware of that. Okay, a couple of other things before we start out. I would want to mention, too, that for those of you who are listening to this stuff for the first time, again, the reason that we're presenting this show in this format is because it is, in fact, an archive show, and longtime listeners are familiar with the stuff that Dave does on his program, Hard Rain, and that I do on my program, One Step Beyond, in which we take smaller segments of this material and current breaking stories that we're following, and put those on the air and quite often take phone calls and things of that nature. However, myself and Dave, for an even longer time, we have been researching this material for quite some time, and obviously we cannot hope to always keep people abreast of everything we've run across during the course of these phone-in shows. So because of that, I guess you could say, without wanting to be overly melodramatic, Radio Free America was born. And we are, in fact, as Dave mentioned, putting these together specifically as archive shows so that a lot of the information that we refer back to in the course of other shows can be put on tape, so that people who find themselves baffled sometimes to be able to come up with the documentation to support things that they feel to be true can refer to some of this material, and then if they so desire, they can use it as a launching pad for their own material.
Of course, everybody's pretty busy. The people have to work or go to school or whatever, and a lot of people just don't have the time to devote to the research that maybe some of us who are real fanatics do. So this is a way, basically, for you to sort of shortcut the whole situation time-wise and still be able to refer to things in a concrete, well-documented fashion. We're very meticulous about giving you all the pertinent information about the sources we use, you know, not only the titles of the books and the authors, but the publisher, the copyright date, and so forth, so that you can actually sit down and take notes off of this stuff and learn it, and then quote from it authoritatively. It's sort of like the old vacuum cleaner salesman. It's a time and work saver. And also, I would add, a money saver. You're not only saving the 2 years of research for every hour or so of taping, but I'd say between the two Radio Free America broadcasts, you're looking at maybe $150, $200 worth of books, and it may be a little expensive putting together, you know, getting all these tapes, but it'd be a whole lot more expensive to get the books, and it would take you a lot of time to find the books, too. So, you know, we realize, again, this is a difficult format. It's a difficult genre of broadcasting, and it's not a finalized thing. We're not... This isn't the slick sort of product that you're going to get on commercial media or even, you know, some of the other non-commercial media. Maybe one difference between what we're trying to do here on KFJC and what other media attempt to do. They attempt to tell you what's going on. We're trying to show you what's going on. And, you know, if it seems like a difficult format, well, as I say, you've got 2 years of research for every hour of taping, and... Well, heck, if those of you who are in school, there's many a doctoral thesis contained within just these first two broadcasts if you'd like to get into it. And although you have to sit down and make some notes and study it a little bit, hey, you're getting a bargain. Take it from us.
Okay, on a slightly more general note before we get into the broadcast, one of the main reasons, again, and this is crucial, especially for people who are just tuning the program in, who perhaps have not heard this kind of broadcast before, and obviously if you haven't listened to our broadcast here at KFJC, you haven't heard this kind of broadcast before. We sort of pride ourselves on the fact that there's not a whole lot of this stuff going around the way we do it. A point needs to be made, a very important point, and just before the show tonight, as a matter of fact, to place this reference in time and let you know that these things are under constant review by Dave and myself. We were just talking on the show before the show started about what we feel to be the sort of the deadness of doctrine and political doctrine in particular, and of course we're dealing with political matters, so it should be made very clear before we start that we're not, Dave and I are not propounding or promoting any particular type of doctrine or political party line or anything of that nature. And we, as Dave mentioned also, we welcome anybody to take this information to go and look at the sources themselves, find out if we misrepresented them in any way. And again, we do have these other shows where you can phone in. We welcome the opportunity for people to call in who have questions, who have arguments, anything of that nature. So bear that in mind. This is our product that we're putting together as we see it. Obviously, there is some personal interpretation involved, and we don't pretend otherwise. But we do our damnedest to make sure that it is as straightforward and as well documented and verified as we possibly can. So we're not trying to sell you anything. What we're mainly trying to do is put some put a bee in your ear as far as some things you're not familiar with, and hopefully help some people who haven't had a chance to begin to think for themselves a little bit and start to wonder about what the real political history of the present era is, because it's an important thing to know.
I would add that those of you who'd like to feedback on this material here, we have another, by now, sort of traditional KFJC broadcast coming up on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, which is this coming Sunday, called Uncle Sam and the Swastika. And the material there will intersect with the material we're talking about here and that we talked about in the first show to a certain extent. And we're hoping to have at least 2.5 hours for phone calls this coming Sunday night. So if you'd like to feedback, you may want to make a couple of notes. You know, if you have a question, jot it down. A comment, jot it down. And there'll be plenty of time to feedback either on the stuff that we talk about Sunday or on the stuff that we're talking about on this show here. So that we will have a good long phone-in session coming up on this coming Sunday, the 27th.
And there is a conceptual overlap between the two broadcasts. I mean, we're dealing with similar, with very close eras in time, and a lot of the same players show up in both broadcasts. So you won't be throwing things off the mark if you do it. One last thing I just wanted to say before we start with the actual material here. And I guess that this will sort of a prologue for you what it is exactly that we're doing with the first couple of things that we're going to read to you. And that is this. We are living in a time, in an era, however you want to phrase it, however lofty you want to be, in which, among other things, human beings have an incredible capacity for self-destruction, technologically and otherwise. And one of the most, to my way of thinking, most frightening things that we are hearing right now is not just the return of the Cold War, but the return of Cold War rhetoric and the deadness of intellect that that implies. The inability of people to think in terms of actualities, to try to assimilate information as to what things actually mean, and instead to fall into convenient catchphrases and knee-jerk attitudes to things. And we see this constantly as regards several very, very serious things going on in the world, not least of which are problems in such places as the Middle East and Central America and our relations with the Soviet Union. And of all times when people cannot afford to subsist and to live intellectually through a rather tarnished decade, namely the 50s, this is probably the one, folks. There's just too much on the line for people to be reliving the Cold War intellectually. And so that's what we're hoping to do tonight, is to make people a little more aware of history so that they can assimilate that information and hopefully use it to start trying to solve some of the problems of the present.
I'd add that the knee-jerk ideological statement goes for both the right and the left. So
indeed.
We're not singling anybody out here for castigation.
All right. Starting off the broadcast, as we started off the first broadcast, I'm going to read you a short excerpt from a book that obviously has become, again, rather famous this year, and that book, of course, is 1984 by George Orwell. And most of you out there are familiar with the plot. Those of you who aren't will probably at least know a little bit about it. It's, needless to say, it's a book about totalitarianism and what totalitarian societies do to their citizens in terms of distorting the information that is handed to them. And, of course, that is a large point of what we're trying to do tonight. So anyway, quoting from George Orwell's 1984, the character speaking is the protagonist, Winston Smith. The party said that Oceania had never been in alliance with Eurasia. He, Winston Smith, knew that Oceania had been in alliance with Eurasia as short a time as 4 years ago. But where did that knowledge exist? Only in his own consciousness, which in any case must soon be annihilated. And if all others accepted the lie which the party imposed, if all records told the same tale, then the lie passed into history and became truth. Who controls the past, ran the party slogan, controls the future. Who controls the present, controls the past. And yet the past, though of its nature alterable, never had been altered. Whatever was true, from everlasting to everlasting. It was quite simple. All that was needed was an unending series of victories over your own memory. Reality control, they called it. In newspeak, doublethink.
Jumping from fiction to fact. Reading now from a book called Facts and Fascism. That book was authored by a man named George Seldes, last named Seldes. He was a prominent anti-fascist writer who was very popular in the 30s and 40s. His work was submerged as a result of McCarthyism in the 50s. The book was published in 1943 by In Fact Incorporated, that in hardcover. Now, in Facts and Fascism, George Seldes quotes from another book, also nonfiction, specifically the German language edition, the 1935 German language edition of Mein Kampf. Adolf Hitler's autobiography. And here Der Führer is talking about lying and the art of lying. And in the 1935 German language edition of Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote as follows, quoted by Seldes: "The size of the lie is a definite factor in causing it to be believed, because the vast masses of a nation are in the depths of their hearts more easily deceived than they are consciously and intentionally bad. The primitive simplicity of their minds renders them more easy victims of a big lie than a small one, because they themselves often tell little lies, but would be ashamed to tell big ones. Such a form of lying would never enter their heads. They would never credit others with the possibility of such great impudence as the complete reversal of facts. Even explanations would long leave them in doubt and hesitation, and any trifling reason would dispose them to accept a thing as true. Something, therefore, always remains and sticks from the most impudent lies, a fact which all bodies and individuals concerned in the art of lying in this world know only too well, and therefore they stop at nothing to achieve this end." Well, you'll recall that at the end of part one of this series, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, we wound up by discussing the fact that really, World War II, at least on the Eastern Front, did not really end. The shooting war did not end in 1945. Now, as the Nazis retreated on the Eastern Front, they set up guerrilla groups to harass the Red Army in its rear. Now, these guerrilla groups combined not only with reactionary and nationalist elements in the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, the Ukraine, and Poland, but also with German troops that had been cut off by the rapid advances of the Red Army during the closing stages of World War II. Now, these guerrilla groups waged a fierce, and we mean very fierce, warfare for almost 7 years. As late as 1952, some of these groups were still active after the formal close of World War II with VE Day in 1945. Now, many of these guerrilla groups were set up by a man named Reinhard Gehlen, last name G-E-H-L-E-N. Now, Gehlen was Adolf Hitler's intelligence chief for the Eastern Front, and his Eastern Front intelligence organization was called Fremde Heere Ost, or Foreign Armies East. And that was Adolf Hitler's intelligence organization, complete and intact. He set up many of these guerrilla groups, notably the Werewolf guerrilla group. And after World War II, Reinhard Gehlen and his entire Eastern Front intelligence organization, Hitler's entire Eastern Front intelligence organization, jumped, complete and intact, to the fledgling CIA. In fact, they were working for U.S. military intelligence even before the CIA came into being. And then when the CIA did come into being in 1947, the Gehlen organization, remember, Hitler's intact intelligence organization from the Eastern Front, became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. They incorporated more than 4,000 SS and Gestapo men, including virtually all of the Sicherheitsdienst, the SD, the SS Intelligence Service, and they became the sole purveyor of intelligence for the United States for more than a decade after the war. They also became, in turn, the official NATO intelligence organization, and then the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German Intelligence Service, which they are to this day. Now, a very important point to keep in mind, and this is where we wound up with last time, was the fact that as Reinhard Gehlen jumped to the CIA, he maintained radio contact with these guerrilla groups that, remember, began as a Third Reich operation and was shipping them weapons and liaison officers in partnership with the CIA. Well, at first, was shipping them weapons and liaison officers in his function for the Third Reich, and then, while working with the CIA, continued to assist the Eastern Front guerrillas, the Axis guerrillas, who in essence simply switched uniforms. So we have a continuation of guerrilla warfare, a continuation of policy, if you will, complete from the Third Reich to the CIA. And these guerrilla groups, they really waged a very fierce warfare. We don't know exactly what the casualties were. two details we mentioned last time were the fact that a Polish military writer referred to a gross casualty figure, perhaps just for Poland, of 12,556 killed. And then we looked at a section of a memorandum from a CIA official named Frank Wisner, W-I-S-N-E-R, and he referred to a Ukrainian fascist organization, which incorporated many SS and Gestapo men, as having killed 35,000 Soviet security personnel from 1945 to 1947 alone. And while that may have been a slight exaggeration, because he was hoping to obtain sponsorship for this group by the CIA through another organ of a national security establishment called the Office of Policy Coordination, it's worth keeping that figure in mind, because again, the shooting did not stop in the Eastern Front in 1945. And it's worth noting, as we read in a passage from a book called The Belarus Secret by a man named John Loftus that we're going to be going back to here in a few minutes, that many of these groups became incorporated with the Special Forces, and that's where we're going to pick up right now.
All right, indeed. One other thing, two quick things that should be pointed out. First of all, to put this back in historical perspective again, which sometimes is difficult when we're talking about this rather complicated and complex information, bear in mind now that while this does not obviously explain the entirety of the Soviet maintenance of presence in Eastern Europe, when you realize the fact that several, maybe tens of thousands of Soviet soldiers were killed by essentially Nazi commandos being supported by the Central Intelligence Agency after the close of World War II, it puts what might be called a different complexion on the issue of Eastern Europe. One other thing, although this doesn't come into place in this article, but as I was reviewing some of the information yesterday, it came to my mind. Those of you who are of faint of heart, some of the information we will be dealing with tonight, even though it's only written and hence spoken information, is rather graphic in terms of violence and things of that nature. So just warning you, if you're squeamish, I don't really know if I can let you know in advance, but some of it is rather unpleasant. We're talking about some rather unpleasant people.
Also worth keeping in mind an analogy that we made last time between the undeclared warfare which was being waged by the CIA against the Soviet Union after World War II is analogous in many ways to the undeclared war currently being waged against Nicaragua by that very same organization, and also using the much-despised Somocistas, which comprise a very important element of the so-called Contras, the guerrillas, the CIA-financed guerrillas in Nicaragua, and of course with the 20 million dead that the Soviet Union suffered in World War II, the use of SS and Gestapo men against that organization was very literally salt in the wounds and certainly aroused much the same kind of fierce outrage on the part of Soviet citizens that the Contras do today.
Indeed, we're talking about a small group of people, as is quite a bit the case we've seen in several other cases in Vietnam and in Central America and South America, where a small group of people in the intelligence and military establishment, without the recourse of voters, without congressional or Senate involvement whatsoever in this so-called democracy, and I don't mean to be sarcastic, but in this situation one has to be a little bit, are in fact conducting foreign policy, a shooting war foreign policy. So bear that in mind. Okay, this first section is from a book by E.H. Cookeridge called Galen, Spy of the Century. It was published by Random House in 1971. This little subheading is entitled Wisner Sets Up CIA's Private Army. Dulles, who is Alan Dulles, had made it clear to Galen that top priority must be given to the selection and training of agents for work in Russia. Wisner had already discussed this with Galen the year before, and also a plan to recruit men from amongst Eastern Europeans for hush-hush armed units to assist insurgents inside communist countries. The plan was not put into practice until 1952, when, after his election, President Eisenhower eased out General Beadle Smith from the CIA and made Alan Dulles its director. His brother, John Foster Dulles, had become Secretary of State just before and was embarking on his policy of brinksmanship. The Dulles brothers believed deeply that Stalin's captive nations would rise against communist oppression given a modicum of encouragement. A private mercenary force was to be established in Germany to be ready for such an emergency and to be employed without involving regular U.S. forces. Who else than Galen was the man to help in laying the foundations for such special forces? He and his former FHO and WALLI men, and also the SS officers who had served in the Brandenburg sabotage units and the Jagdkommandos against the Red Army and Soviet partisans, had all the experience that was needed. There was no problem of finding enough volunteers among the many hundreds of thousands of displaced persons who still lived in misery in crowded camps. Skipping down, many were unemployable, but the younger ones found lowly and poorly paid jobs on the land or as industrial laborers, clearing bomb rubble and working on the rebuilding of German cities. They provided a vast reservoir of potential recruits for the American-sponsored units, in which living conditions would be paradise compared with the utter misery of their present existence. The Ukrainians, Byelorussians, Poles, Latvians, Estonians, Lithuanians, and the motley crowd of Russo-Asian nationals who represented the remnants of Vlasov's 600,000-strong Army of Liberation attracted Wisner's and Galen's attention.
The Vlasov Army, by the way, was an organization headed by a captured Red Army general named Andrei Vlasov, which fought for the Third Reich during World War II.
In the space of 2 years, about 5,000 were enlisted by Wisner and Galen, assembled in camps at Bad Wiessee, at Kaufbeuren in Bavaria, and at the U.S. Army Hammond Barracks near Mannheim, and trained by American officers and former German Wehrmacht and Waffen-SS NCOs. At Kaufbeuren, the commandant and chief instructor was Major Ronald Otto Bollenbach, former U.S. Assistant Military Attaché in Moscow. These units became the nucleus of CIA's private army, later better known as the Green Berets, in Vietnam. Some of them are today still stationed in West Germany. The 5th Special Reconnaissance Group, now entirely airborne, at Oberursel, and the 10th Special Group in Bavaria.
Now, Frank Wisner entrusted the formation of the first general staff, so to speak, for the Special Forces, again, the Green Berets as we came to know them in Vietnam, to the aforementioned Reinhard Galen. Now remember, Galen was Hitler's intelligence chief for the Eastern Front and then jumped to CIA. Now, in forming the Special Forces, Reinhard Galen turned to three Nazi war criminals who had worked for the Third Reich, and they then functioned for Galen in putting together the Special Forces. Once again, reading from Galen, Spy of the Century, by E.H. Cookridge, hardcover edition, Random House, 1971. Galen alerted several of his assistants who had a thorough knowledge and first-hand experience of Eastern European countries and their people, and also approached an acknowledged expert on anything about the East whom he had known and admired since his school days in Breslau. He was Dr. Michael Akmeteli, A-C-H-M-E-T-E-L-I, born in 1887 in Borjom in the Caucasus, where his father amassed a great fortune when oil was discovered on his land by British and American mining engineers, amongst them the latter president of the United States, Herbert Hoover. Interrupting very briefly, you'll recall that in the first part of Radio Free America, the first show of Radio Free America, we discussed Herbert Hoover, his massive industrial holdings and mineral holdings in the USSR, and how he used food relief intended for the starving peoples of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union to finance a number of different reactionary armies against Russia, notably the German army of General von der Goltz, and he also financed the Russo-Polish War, too. So keep in mind that this Herbert Hoover thread runs right through till the end of the Second World War, and we're going to touch on Hoover again a little later in the broadcast. Returning to Galen, Spy of the Century. He was Dr. Michael Akmeteli, born in 1887 in Borjom in the Caucasus, where his father amassed a great fortune when oil was discovered on his land by British and American mining engineers, amongst them the latter president of the United States, Herbert Hoover. During the Revolution, Akmeteli had fought with the White Armies against the Bolsheviks and eventually came to Germany, becoming a lecturer in Slavonic studies at Breslau University. He was a close friend of the Galen family. Several of Akmeteli's books, in which he expounded Germany's mission of civilizing communist Russia, unquote, were published by Ferdinand Herd & Son, of which Galen's father was manager. Akmatelli had been closely connected with Abwehr intelligence in its early days. The Ost Institute, or East Institute, he founded, was in fact a front for espionage against Poland and the Soviet Union even before the Nazi regime. Under Hitler, he had become professor and head of the Institute for the Study of Communism in the USSR. We're going to talk about that again in a couple of minutes. As a friend of Hitler's chief theoretician of the Nazi Aryan doctrine, Alfred Rosenberg, his advice was needed at OKW. OKW is Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, German military high command, and he also acted as a super analyst for Galen's FHO. In 1945, Akmatelli went into hiding, afraid that the Allies might hand him over to the Soviets, but he later reappeared under the alias of Dr. A.K. Michael at Unterweilbach, a village in the shadow of the former Dachau concentration camp near Munich, where Galen obtained for him a villa paid for from CIA funds. Professor Akmatelli went to work with two Pulak officers selected by Galen to form the first staff of the secret special forces. One was another academic, Dr. Franz Alfred Six, last name S-I-X, ex-lecturer at Königsberg University, who had managed to combine his scholarly vocation with service in the SS. He had risen to the rank of SS Brigadeführer, equivalent to Brigadier General, and had became head of Section 7 at Himmler's RSHA. RSHA, by the way, is the Reich Sicherheitshauptamt. We're going to talk about that, too, in a second. He had dived under after the collapse of the Third Reich, but Allied intelligence officers searching out war criminals found him after 2 years. In April of 1948, Six came before a U.S. military tribunal at Nuremberg, charged with having ordered the executions of civilians, including hundreds of Jews, when in command of a Jagdkommando in July and August of 1941 at Smolensk. Jagdkommandos were the feared SS anti-partisan units on the Eastern Front. Interrupting here. They achieved a terrible reputation for brutality. Returning to Galen's spy of the century, Judge Dixon sentenced Six to 20 years imprisonment. However, 4 years later, Six was free and busy advancing the fruition of the CIA-Galen project. The third member of the triumvirate was Dr. Emil Augsburg, A-U-G-S-B-U-R-G, born in 1904 in Lodz in Poland, according to official Polish sources, of Jewish parentage, which, if true, did not hamper his ultimate admission to the SS, in which he rose to become Standartenführer, or colonel, heading a section attached to Adolf Eichmann's S4 department, which handled the Jewish problem, with final results that are well known. After the collapse, Augsburg fled, as did Eichmann, with the assistance of Odessa, that's an organization of ex-SS men which helped SS war criminals flee after the war. Beginning again, after the collapse, Augsburg fled, as did Eichmann, with the assistance of Odessa to Italy, where he found charitable aid from circles close to the Vatican, which helped escape Nazis. After a year or two, when he rightly assumed that enough grass had grown over the past, he returned to Germany as Dr. Althaus and was enrolled by Galen, working first as manager of the Karlsruhe Branch L and then at Pulak. Interrupting again, Pulak was the town in Germany where the Galen organization was first based, P-U-L-L-A-C-H. These three experts prepared the briefs for the would-be agents to be sent into Russia, assembling masses of topographical material, information about everyday life in Soviet towns and villages, and up-to-date regulations about travel, police registration, food distribution, etc., in order to make the agents' movements as safe as possible. And, again, one of the reasons we're going into this, of course, is that the special forces are something which we hear a great deal about today, not only because of their involvement in Vietnam, but I guess certainly, one could almost talk about a kind of mercenary chic that's become very fashionable these days. Everybody's walking down the street with their camouflaged pants on and so forth, and the special forces have become a very important element of U.S. foreign policy. They're currently training the aforementioned Contras in Nicaragua, as well as the El Salvadorian security forces, something that we're going to talk about in a little bit.
Bear in mind also that one of the other points, again, to be taken in its historical framework, is that we're talking now about the changeover from a military intelligence service with direct purpose, namely the OSS and the various Army intelligence services, etc., to a peacetime intelligence service that was basically mandated to be a gatherer of intelligence. However, within a couple of years of its inception, it had already become an intelligence service that was not only gathering information, but was in fact waging undeclared warfare all over the world. Now, one has to ask, did the fact that the early recruitment was almost primarily of Nazi war criminals have anything to do with this particular historical development? We're going to read another section here on the further adventures, or on a little bit of elaboration on the adventures of the gentleman who began the special forces. This is from a book entitled The General Was a Spy by Heinz Hoehne, H-O-H-N-E, and Hermann Zolling, Zolling. This is copyright 1972 by Coward, McCann, and never have figured that one out.
Call it Jogan. Why don't you spell it for him and let them pronounce it?
Right, G-E-O-G-H-E-G-A-N. Joe Geegan, who knows? Anyway, Incorporated. That was copyright 1972. You can find the book without knowing how to spell that. Okay, reading from the book. The more unsuccessful the Abwehr's operations in the East, however, and that is, of course, military, not the SS.
Interrupting briefly, the Abwehr was standard German military intelligence.
Right. The more unsuccessful the Abwehr's operations in the East, however, the more eager the SD, which is the intelligence division of the SS, the more eager the SD became to annex the prerogative of collecting Russian intelligence. The SD faithfuls were obsessed with the crazy notion that Soviet communism was merely another manifestation of world Jewry's thirst for power. That's world Jewry. It's an expression you don't hear that much unless you pick pamphlets up off of street corners and stuff. J-E-W-R-Y, meaning the world Jewish presence. The SD faithfuls were obsessed with the crazy notion that Soviet communism was merely another manifestation of world Jewry's thirst for power, and the overthrow of the Soviet regime would accordingly be a service to Aryan mankind. So, the SD rejected the Abwehr's traditional picture of Russia. They dreamed of an impotent, even a dismembered Russia, a target for the SD's secret service. The SD leaders allied themselves with Russian émigrés, who sensed in Heydrich's and Schellenberg's machine a force which might one day bring them back to Russia. A typical representative of this émigré society was Michael Akhmeteli, a Georgian agricultural expert, employed as a reader in Breslau University. He joined the camp of the SS, who expected him to provide the expertise for their anti-Russian fantasies in the East. The SS forced the East European Institute of Breslau University to relinquish its library and other scientific apparatus. Armed with these, the SD set up for Professor Akhmeteli a research institute, known from its location as the Wannsee Institute, spelled W-A-N-N-S-E-E.
That's a name we're going to be touching on throughout the broadcast, so remember it.
That's right. Okay, so the SD sets up for Akhmeteli the Wannsee Institute. Akhmeteli recruited other Eastern experts and émigrés, men such as SS Untersturmführer Emil Augsburg, who, of course, you just also heard about. His senior assistant responsible for questions of nationality groups in Russia, Dr. Swetchin, the cartographer, and Dr. Speer, the librarian. They assembled material on Russia, built up a card index of personalities, prepared maps, and built up a detailed picture of conditions in Soviet Russia.
A couple of interesting points about that passage. First of all, keep in mind that Dr. Akhmeteli, whose father, remember, had amassed a fortune in Russian oil with Herbert Hoover, had basically seen the Third Reich as his ticket back into Russia and also presumably back into the chips, okay? Now, this is very similar to a pattern that we looked at throughout the first broadcast, in which As early as the armistice which ended World War I, Section 12 of that armistice allowed for the German troops that were in the Baltic states to remain in place. And we have seen the pattern established as early as the period of the Russian Civil War of people, not only white Russian émigrés, but also those foreign nationals who had significant industrial and financial holdings in Russia, seeking to use the Germans as their ticket back into Russia and back into that extraordinary wealth that they had been deprived of by the revolution. So once again, we see Mr. Akhmatilli using, and remember, this is the SS intelligence service. The Sicherheitsdienst was the SS intelligence service, and all of the real heavies were Sicherheit. Well, I can't say all of the real heavies, but most of the names that have become infamously associated with Nazi atrocities were Sicherheitsdienst. Eichmann, the Klaus Barbie who we're going to talk about, all of these men were SD, Reinhard Heydrich. The final solution was accomplished by the SD.
Okay, bear in mind also, now once again, that one of the key, the reason this is a key point is that this collaboration with the CIA, and in fact the beginnings of the Special Forces, was not accomplished by people who could perhaps, as maybe some of the scientists or the lesser lights in the Army military intelligence, could claim that they were in fact forced or that they were doing their job. When we're talking about the SS and especially the SD, we are talking about the creme de la creme, if you can use such a term, of Nazi mentality, Nazi ideology, people who were Nazis to the core. You had to be to reach this position in the Nazi hierarchy. So, again, when we're talking about things, when we're talking about the profound anti-communism of the early days of the CIA, which is carried over, of course, to the present day and to our present administration, among other things, bear in mind we're talking about that the entire Eastern Front Intelligence Service is made up of people whose sworn credo is that Soviet communism is a species of international Jewish terrorism. Okay?
Exactly. Keep in mind that the Nazis who talked about the Soviets as the Jewish Bolshevik commissars, again, it's difficult to explain it, but they saw communism and Judaism as really one and the same thing, although, you know, that communism grew out of Judaism. And so this organization, which was the Russian Institute, the Wannsee Institute, was not just an organization for espionage against Russia, it also was inextricably caught up with Hitler's final solution to the so-called Jewish problem, under which, of course, the European Jewry was all but extinguished. So we have here Mr. Akhmatilli and the aforementioned Emil Augsburg, who was sort of in charge of Jewish classification. And again, it's difficult to explain what that meant. But the point that should be made here is that Akhmatilli and Augsburg, who helped form the first general staff of the Special Forces, worked together on Hitler's final solution.
Okay, and now what we're going to hear about is how we're going to tie the third member of this little triumvirate, of Galen's Special Forces triumvirate, into the final solution. This is from The Order of the Death's Head, also by Heinz Hoene, the author of the last book. This is copyright 1966 by Ballantine, and it says, "Whenever opportunity offered, the SD spared no effort to prove that unwanted non-Nazis were of Jewish origin. Professors Ernst and Heinrich Serafim, for instance, both of whom came from Poland, had refuted the rumor current in the party that they were of Jewish origin. The SD, however, spied a chance, quote, to prove the assertion that Serafim is of Jewish origin on the basis of the facts as set out herein, unquote. But they proceeded cautiously. An SD man named Augsburg," again, our Emil Augsburg that we were just talking about, "was instructed to urge the German Association in Poland to find a student willing to trace Serafim's family tree. But again, caution. Quote, in conversation with," and then there's a serial number, "SS Sturmbannführer Sieks approved the procedure proposed by Augsburg." Now that again is Franz Alfred Sieks, the same gentleman that we were just talking about a moment ago as being another part of the triumvirate. "In conversation with," and then a code number for another agent, "SS Sturmbannführer Sieks approved the procedure proposed by Augsburg. Care was to be taken, however, that the source of these instructions should not become known. So, SS Colonel Seeks was also involved in the formulation of propaganda and linking unwantedness with Jewishness and things of that nature, working for Augsburg.
So what we have here, we have Seeks, Augsburg, and Akmatelli all involved with the so-called Jewish section, the S4 section. In other words, all three of the men who worked for the special forces were involved in basically executing, and I guess the term could be used advisedly, Hitler's policy against the Jews. And these are the same three who went to work first forming the special forces.
Okay. Now, the question is what happened? I mean, weren't these people all, you know, going to prison for war crimes? I mean, you know, they were involved in the Final Solution. They were involved in the slaughter of hundreds of people, as Sieks was at Smolensk. You know, what happened? Well, here's a very partial example of the kinds of things that happened. This is from the Bolaris Secret by John Loftus. John Loftus, by the way, was a U.S. government official who happened to stumble onto the Bielorussian Nazi situation of our importation of Bielorussian Nazis into the United States and into U.S. Intelligence circles, and which got him a little irked, I suppose, and led him to do the research that led to this book. So once again, this is from the Bolaris Secret, B-E-L-A-R-U-S, by John Loftus, copyright 1982, Alfred A. Knopf. And Loftus writes as follows. Galen suggested that Wisner, that's Frank Wisner, the American, hire Dr. Franz Seeks to head the recruitment and training of the special forces, the Green Berets. Seeks knew most of the leading Bielorussians, he explained, having recruited them for Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia. Seeks, however, was at that moment on trial for his crimes at Nuremberg. Wisner asked General Clay to intercede with a Nuremberg prosecutor and judges. Whether Clay took such action is unknown, but Seeks received only a 20-year prison term, while the rest of the Einsatzgruppen and commanders were sentenced to death. In 1950, Clay's successor, High Commissioner John J. McCloy, commuted the sentence to time served, and Seeks went to work for Galen on the Special Forces project. Now, some people out there could make the case that it was merely a coincidence that everybody else who was up for trial received the death sentence, and that Seeks only got a 20-year prison term, and that in 1950 John McCloy came in and just happened to commute his sentence to time served, and that the person who was the, if not admitted, at least testified to murder of hundreds of people, himself personally responsible in Smolensk, and also involved in the Nazi racial legislation and the Final Solution and things of that nature. Well, I suppose the case could be made, you'd have a long way to go in making it, that was a coincidence.
Now recall that John McCloy is a name that we've seen before. We looked at him in the very first part of the broadcast. He was Hitler's personal guest at the 1936 Olympics, okay, so certainly he was no stranger to Third Reich personnel. He was, again, Hitler's personal guest at the 36 Olympics. He then became Under Secretary of War and specifically was regarded in that capacity as